Let's bring the Alzheimer Commerce Committee to order at 3:28 on March 29th, year 2000. For the record, present are Chairman Rothberg, Vice Chairman Halker, Representatives Bryce, Cisna, Harris, and Murkowski. We have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar is Senate Bill 193, Board and Commission appointments to the Board of Marine Pilots. And as I mentioned last week, I wanted to bring up HB 345, State Employee Health Insurance, and I wanted to make sure all the bargaining units were informed and invited to hear. And I would like to bring up under bills previously heard, which I didn't have an opportunity to announce on the floor today, if we can get to it, HB 339. We do have, a floor session at 5? Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll expeditiously finish before we leave. With that, I would like to invite the representative from Senator Pierce's office to come forward and give us the information. Senate Bill 193.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Chris Noss, legislative aide to Senator Drew Pierce, representing District F in Anchorage. Senate Bill 193 was introduced on behalf of Senator Pierce in regards to a constituent who attained membership with the Alaska Business and Industry Newspaper Publishing Company. She was hired in the fall of 1998, and I believe she is online. Her name is Margaret Bowman. Ms. Bowman had arrears that reached the amount of $10,000 during this relationship before termination of employment, or the employment relationship was ceased. At this time, Ms. Bowman went to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development looking for some type of get these arrears back. And the problem that was run into was that the maximum cap was $7,500 that an employee is allowed to retain. Senate Bill 193 is a modification of that law that raises it to $20,000. And basically, as her arrears reached $10,000, it was not feasible for her to gain legal representation on a contingency fee basis. So SB 193 would alleviate that, making it possible for her to get these funds back. And I believe there is a letter enclosing your packets from Ms. Bowman, and also referring to Representative Halcrow in those. And also, I do have two representatives from the Department of Workforce and Labor Development, Mr. Al Dwyer and Dwight Perkins, to answer any technical questions, as well as Randy Carr, who's online.
Questions, sponsor, representative.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I could expand a little more. Ms. Bowman is my constituent, along with Senator Pierce's, and I had a lengthy conversation with her this summer about what's happened. Told her I would follow up on it. My conversation led me to Randy Carr, who told me that, really, looking back historically, it's been at 7,500 because the Bar Association and associated attorneys organizations have been, in the past, hesitant to allow the state to go after any more, fearing that it would encroach on their business. But in this day and age, it is highly unlikely you'll find an attorney to pursue anything less than $20,000. So during the interim work with Senator Pierce's office, we talked to the Bar Association and some other groups that did not have a problem raising it from $7,500 to $20,000, and talked to Deputy Commissioner Perkins this summer, along with the commissioner, actually, and they seem to support it. So I have a companion piece of legislation introduced on the House side to do the same thing, and it's really raises the limits in a time where they need to be raised. So I appreciate Senator Pierce's representative being here today.
Representative Harris,
just a the question to the previous speaker: Where's your legislation at?
The agreement was that Senator Pierce would move hers.
Representative Bryce, do you have a question?
When was the $7,500 established?
Quite recently by the House Judiciary Committee, about 2 or 3 years ago. Matter of fact, we did raise the limit, I think, from $5,000 to $7,500.
That's right.
Matter of fact, the courts have other reasons that are concerned about it. Representative Harris, follow up.
To the sponsor, in your opening remarks, you said that, I believe I heard you right, you said the Department of Labor and Workforce Development is supportive of this bill?
Correct. Also, we have been working with some defense attorneys that are more familiar with legal aspects of that, and we have made a couple amendments primarily regarding into double penalizing on liquidation. And those have all been met also. So as far as we know, all agreements, everyone is okay with this bill.
Well, we can
including
get
the court system.
Do you have any complaints, Mr. Chairman? This is Al DeWire, Director of Labor Standards and Safety. As far as I know, we haven't got any bad vibes from the court system on this issue.
Well, this has a further referral to judiciary, doesn't it? But in the, on the Senate side, you didn't.
No, we had a finance referral on the Senate side, Labor and Commerce and Finance referral.
Representative McCaskill.
Thank you. Just to follow up on it, do you have any idea what this is going to mean to the courts in terms of an increase in caseload to the small claims court?
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCaskill, we've assumed, I think it was
possibly 120.
Yeah, about 120 cases, and out of those cases, out of those claims, possibly 10 or 20 would actually end up in court.
Mm, okay. Annually, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Mr. Dwyer, I take that because this will give you this bill could give you some leverage with dealing with the people. Is that part of the theory?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we turn away a lot of people because, you know, of the 7,500 cap. So it's we're just turning away people we could help. Mm-hmm. And this law will allow us to help those people.
Al, I remember my conversation with Randy Carr this summer. He said that there are currently penalties in place now that kind of act as a hammer there. So people have, obviously, those in arrears have a vested interest to pay up as soon as possible because the penalties are pretty steep. And so that, he was saying, that kind of mitigates the number of cases that actually get to court because of these penalty provisions that are already in place. So, okay.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, if the employment is terminated, the employer has within 3 days to pay arrears.
And for the committee's information, we do have Randy Carr, Ms. J. Seymour, and Ms. Marva Bauman online to testify. So. Any further questions of the sponsor or the department at this juncture? Seeing none, let the record show that Representative Sanders is in attendance. With that, I'd like to go to Ms. Bauman in Anchorage. Ms. Bauman, could you give us your name and your testimony, please?
Hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I have written testimony here, and I do have a copy to give to the legislature with some other documents.
Great.
Should I just go ahead and testify now?
Yes, ma'am. Please give us your name and your testimony, please.
Okay. My name is Margaret Bauman. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 193, legislation to raise the amount of back wages for residents, which the state can pursue through the court system. At present, the Labor Department can only pursue amounts of up to $7,500, and my former employer owes me in excess of $10,000. The employer, Business News Alaska, has refused to pay me any of the amounts since last July, although the company has acknowledged in writing that they owe me the money. At the time, I worked as news editor for Business News Alaska, a monthly business publication in Anchorage, from October 1998 through July 1999. I was also caring for an elderly parent at home. My mother was not in good health and needed 24-hour care, so I needed a job I could do largely at home, except for hours when I had a caregiver or my mother was in daycare. Business News Alaska hired everyone on a contract labor basis. I had no idea at the time the practice was illegal, as the State Labor Department has twice since concluded. As the company became further and further behind in paying me, the publisher, Kay Cashman, continued to hire other people and kept coming up with excuses for not paying up. When we parted company last summer, I asked for the money due me within 3 working days. Kay said I was not an employee and she could pay me in the indefinite future. I inquired if the Labor Department filled out paperwork for them to make a determination, as did Kay Cashman. The department spent a lot of time studying the situation and concluded I was an employee. So did the Internal Revenue Service. Ms. Cashman and her publishing partner, Raylene Combs, then appealed the Labor Department decision. The hearing officer for the appeal also concluded I was an employee. And the state is now studying all the records of Business News Alaska because the company hired most people on a contract basis with no benefits and no taxes held. Now Business News Alaska is appealing the matter again on the commissioner level. It's a good thing the Labor Department took my case because even if I could afford an attorney to handle my side, I've been advised that given her track record, Cashman has no intention of paying me any of the money she owes. I have with me for the legislature copies of records which I paid for myself from Moxnet Computer Service showing that Ms. Cashman has numerous debts outstanding, including a $35,000 judgment against her in the state superior court. She's never paid a dime on that judgment either. To cover herself, she lists herself as a publisher and her son and a partner, Raylene Combs, as owners. Changing the state law to allow the Labor Department to pursue through the court system back wages would benefit residents like myself who have no other recourse. It would also put companies like Business News Alaska on notice that this state will not tolerate employers who think they can operate outside the law. Senate Bill 193 would make Alaska a fairer playing field for employers who do operate under the law and are at a disadvantage when other employers are allowed to operate outside the law. Thank you.
Any questions of Ms. Bauman? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Bauman, and we hope that this bill is successful and that you're successful with your future lawsuit. Going on, we'd like to hear from Mr. Jay Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay Seymour, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 193 that's currently written. I must tell you, I had some concerns with the bill when it was first introduced, both in the forms it was introduced in the House and the Senate, but I think it's currently crafted. It's a fair bill that I think accomplishes a couple of things. By way of background, I'm an attorney with the law firm of Perkins Coie. My practice is almost exclusively on labor and employment matters. I've been in Alaska for over 25 years. I currently serve as the election labor affairs director for both the Anchorage Society for Resource Management and the State Council for Human Resource Management, although the views here are expressed on my own. As I mentioned, I do support Senate Bill 193. I can tell the committee that in my work as an employment lawyer, the most aggravating set of laws that employers face are the wage and hour laws. From an employer perspective, they often result in a windfall for employees who have been fairly paid. In my experience, I have often seen employees who have been paid $40,000 a year, $1,000 a year, or even $80,000 or $90,000 a year, when settlements or judgments in excess of $100,000 for unpaid overtime on the basis of a good faith dispute between them and their employer. To add insult to injury, the current law provides for a waiting time penalty which a court can impose for not having paid the overtime that was in dispute, even though it may have been a good faith dispute. Paradoxically, there are some gaps in the law, as Ms. Bauman just testified, that don't allow the Department of Labor to pursue those unscrupulous employers with wage claims that are much smaller than the claims that we normally see brought by the plaintiffs bar. I think that Senate Bill 193 is a good first step towards providing some relief on both ends of the spectrum, both for those who are paid at a minimum wage or don't have large claims, at the same time bringing a little bit of sanity for those who have already been fairly paid and have claims in excess of $30,000 or $40,000. The bill provides additional authority to the department to enforce the labor laws of the state of Alaska, and I do believe that those are claims that ordinarily would not be brought by most of the attorneys in the plaintiff's bar. It also provides some relief to those employers who face overtime claims so that they don't have to face the claim of additional penalties. That's simply been a good faith mistake in the application of the law. So in summation, I do support the bill, and I commend it to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seymour, for your testimony. Any questions, Mr. Seymour? Representative McCaskill.
Thank you. Jay, perhaps I was a little bit confused by the testimony prior to yours. I understood her to say that there was some discussion or argument as to whether or not she was an independent contractor or an employee. This bill that we've got in front of us requires certain action within that 3-day period. So if I, as the employer, am looking at the situation and saying, well, wait a minute, you're not my employee, you're an independent contractor, are we making any allowances for that argument?
As I read the bill, Representative Murkowski, this would not affect that. The determination of whether an individual is an employer or an independent contractor would be determined by other provisions of law, which, in my experience, are fairly liberal in favor of the employee. And I'm not familiar with the facts in this case, but I understand it to be that there were a lot of indices that Ms. Bauman was, in fact, an employee under the law in this particular case, even though she was labeled an independent contractor. And the Department of Labor or a court would make the determination of a threshold issue.
Okay, and recognizing that they would, in fact, do that, but this legislation requires that it be paid 3 days afterwards, and if you fail to do that, you've got certain penalties that the employer is facing. So I guess if this were to pass, if I were making the argument that no, I was not an employee, I was in fact an independent contractor, my employer would be wise to just go ahead and pay me right up front and then argue about it later. Is that kind of the direction that things would take?
A couple of things. Number one, the law as it currently is written provides for the 3-day payments.
Right.
It doesn't change that. I guess in most instances, a contractor, someone who's labeled a contractor, would be claiming that they were in fact an employee and therefore would be covered by the law. It's sort of unlikely that the circumstances run all the other direction. And this law doesn't impact that determination either way. That would be a separate determination. But you're right. The employer wants to be conservative, and there is some question about whether the worker is in fact an independent contractor or is really an employee. The employer would be well advised to make the payment of all wages or contract amounts to within the time stipulated by law.
Thanks.
And Randy Carr is here. You may have some additional thoughts on that.
Yes, Representative Jesse, the question that you pose is not an unusual circumstance with regard to the actual...
Mr. Carr, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. This is Randy Carr. I'm the Chief of Labor Standards for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It's not unusual that an individual presenting a wage claim as responded to by the employer in such a manner that the employer wants to lay out a number of possible defenses. One of them may be the fact that they think they're an independent contractor. And the way the law currently reads and the way the bill also reads would allow the employer to settle with the Department of Labor at an administrative level, which basically means we can conduct the investigation to determine from the facts whether...
Hello?
Whether or not the individual is an employment or an employee or an independent contractor. Once we make that determination, if the finding is that the individual is an employee, then the matter becomes one of trying to affect a resolution as to the amount due and get payment from the employer. Once that determination has been made, if the employer resolves this matter administratively with the department, the waiting time penalties that are addressed in this statute are not a factor. The way the statute is applied now and the way it would be applied as amended would be that the waiting time penalties are there as an incentive to get the employer to deal in good faith with the Department of Labor. If a resolution cannot be reached and the Department of Labor is compelled to take the matter to court, then the waiting time penalties in that action would become mandatory, but only in that situation. At all other points up until that time, they are a bargaining chip that can be used to reach a negotiated settlement.
Representative McCaskey.
Thank you. I just need to be walked through it a little bit better than, as I read B, you've got three working days after termination to make payment, and then under subsection D, if you do not do it within that 3 working day period, then you are subject to the employer, or to the penalties upon the employer, and there isn't this waiting period that you're talking about. I maybe that's what I'm missing, is where's the reference to this, to the waiting period? You've got to get through this administrative process where you all settle out whether or not you are an employee or an independent contractor.
As the statute reads right now, Senator, or excuse me, Representative, the waiting time penalties are discretionary and must be awarded by a court. They cannot be awarded by the Department of Labor. And the present language requires that any party who seeks to collect waiting time penalties get a judgment from the court awarding them. So absent a court action, there is no actual waiting time penalty. It is out there as an incentive. It is out there as a disincentive for employers who don't wish to pay. And if matters have to be taken to the court, either in the private sector or by the department, then we prey upon the court to award waiting time penalties.
That is what I needed.
The administrative time frame necessary to try and effect a negotiated resolution short of any penalties being assessed.
Thank you. That was the information I was missing.
Representative Halcrow.
Thank you. And Randy, that goes to the heart of our discussion last August when you were talking about some employees will simply just string you out and then take you to court. But these new the penalty provisions that were put in place recently act as kind of a deterrent for that, because people know at the end of the day they can string you out, but at the end of the day they may just suffer the consequences of some heavy penalties.
Yes, Representative Halcrow, that's exactly what this bill would now do. With the penalties that we're talking about used to be, prior to 1981, a mandatory penalty. In 81, they were relaxed and discretion was given to the court to award or not award the penalties. What we have now before us is a compromise in matters brought by the State Department of Labor. If we are compelled to go to court to prosecute on behalf of someone to collect their wages, any appropriate waiting time penalties would be mandatory. In private cases, it would still be up to the court at their discretion to award waiting time penalties or to not award waiting time penalties, except for one particular situation, which we have carved out as a result of discussing this bill with J.C. Moore and others, and that is addressed in subsection E, section 5, paragraph F. If it's an action brought strictly for overtime in a private sector that results in an award of the overtime and liquidated damages, which is an entirely separate penalty under chapter or title 23.10.110, then the liquid or waiting time penalties under this statute would not come into effect. And that language has been worked out as a compromise, and I believe that both Mr. Seymour and the people he represents and our side of the table are very satisfied with that language.
Mr. Carr, can you tell us under 2310 what the liquidated damages provisions can be, or what does that amount to? It's an F.
The liquidated damages under 2310 are a damage that is equal to the amount of unpaid minimum wage or unpaid overtime. It is a punitive damage. And under the current statutory construction, the employer may assert a good faith defense to his violation. And if that defense is acceptable to the court has the authority to waive some or all of the liquidated damages in cases brought in the private sector. In cases brought by the Department of Labor, the liquidated damages are mandatory. Again, the mandatory aspect of these penalties in cases brought by the Department of Labor are not there specifically to roll up the dollar value of the case, but to offer an incentive to the employer to negotiate harder and reach a settlement with the department short of court action.
But then, if I'm reading subsection, or section 5, subsection F of 140, if you go into small claim court under this provision, you could get the mandated liquidated damages as well as the Section E damages also. Is that, perhaps you can straighten me out here so I have an understanding.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct, because the damages are each different violations of different laws.
Okay.
The liquidated damages are, in 2310, are for a violation, a failure to pay a minimum wage, or a failure to pay overtime. The waiting time penalties here are for a failure to pay whatever might be due. It could be vacation pay, it could be wages altogether, or it could be minimum wage or overtime that the employee is entitled to.
But you've indicated that the reason you have the waiting time penalties, and particularly like the F section, liquidated damages, which would be mandatory, mm-hmm. is to try to get a settlement before you go to court, but that doesn't square up with you're already in, we're giving you a free pass to the small claims court right out of the chute now.
Well, not so much that this bill is giving us a pass to small claims court, sir. It is giving us the ability to take a claim into our offices to administratively investigate it and to attempt to resolve it. We can't even take that claim now because it's over our statutory limit. And our track record has about an 85 to 90% resolution administratively, short of ever having to go to court.
Well, so there's a, I wasn't aware that there was a statutory limitation on your jurisdiction.
Yeah, 7,500.
Oh. Well, that's a, I thought that was
it's
a small claims court.
Just,
it just happens to be the same thing.
Yep.
Oh.
I thought it was.
I misunderstood that. I thought this was an action I'd taken in a small claims court. Oh. That clears up a lot of things.
May I ask a question?
You certainly may, Representative Castle.
Thank you. Just to follow up with Representative Roepberg's comments then, so do I understand correctly that you can get both, or you can be assessed both liquidated damages as well as the waiting time penalty?
Yes, Representative Murkowski, that is correct. That is the current status of the law and is not changed by this bill. The changes that are affected by this bill would be if the Department of Labor brings a case to court and has to go to through the court process to judgment, then those penalties will be mandatory. In the private sector, they may either be discretionary if awarded by the court. Let's say someone takes a claim for unpaid vacation and unpaid wages, and they get an attorney to take a case to court for them. Then the court can award the waiting time penalties or not. If the claim, as identified in Section 5F, is strictly for overtime, such as the case that Mr. Seymour is referring to, where he has an individual who is a highly paid person who files an overtime claim. Usually those arise out of a dispute over whether the individual was exempt from overtime or not. And so they have an overtime claim for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. They win that claim. They also get liquidated damages awarded by the court. In that situation, this bill says waiting time penalties would not apply because it's a highly paid individual in the first place, and it's a large claim. And the compromise here is that the liquidated damages should suffice for the recovery, and the waiting time penalties should not be an issue.
But still, a private party could bring it under this bill, bring an action in a small claims court for a wage arrearage, wage and hour claim up to $20,000. Is that not correct?
No, that's not correct, sir. Only the Department of Labor can bring an action in small claims court for $20,000. All other issues in small claims court are subject to the $7,500 cap set in the small claims statute.
Well, this is only an instance of the department taking up the case. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And therefore, the penalties wouldn't apply, or they would apply, though.
Yes, they would.
The existing statute has the demand for payment. We're talking about the subsection D, penalties under 140. The time for demand triggers the amount of damages at the time that you make the demand for the payment. What constitutes making a demand for the time of payment?
In almost all cases that we bring forward, demand is going to be set by the Department of Labor's first notice to the employer. In the rare case, the employee has actually articulated a demand for their wages in writing, and that can set the deadline. But in most cases, there's not been that sort of a formalization in the dispute until it comes to the department and we send out the wage claim notice and make demand for payment. That starts the clock running. In the private sector, it may well be more frequent that the demand is established in writing because the party has usually received legal counsel sometime well before the filing of the lawsuit, and counsel would advise them to place the demand in writing.
Well, looks like there's an incentive to drag your feet here. Out to 90 days, the lesser of, to make the demand, so your award could be bigger?
No, sir. The award only starts from the day of demand until the day of payment. If someone waits 45 days before they demand their wages, the clock doesn't start until the 48th day. And that's when the 90 days begin to run.
Okay. Okay, further questions of Ms. Carr or any witnesses? Oh, Mr. Seymour?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
In your capacity as a counsel on these types of wage and hour, you represent both sides of both employees and employers normally, or what is your typical practice?
Typically, I represent only employers.
Okay. So you are satisfied with the conditions that in this bill now?
Well, as I said in my testimony, I think it's a good first step. There are a lot of other provisions in the law that are not covered by this, but I am satisfied with a well-balanced bill.
Very good. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 193? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony on Senate Bill 193. Any discussion? Representative Halker.
I would make a motion if you'd entertain one.
I certainly would.
I move CS for Senate Bill number 193, Finance Version I, out of committee with individual recommendations in the attached to zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so next we'll take up the consideration of the government. Governor's appointees to the Board of Marine Pilots. And while you're signing that, in order to take up time, we have before us the nominations by the governor for the Board of Marine Pilots. And in accordance with AS 3905080, this is a review by the Labor and Commerce Committee of the qualifications. And execution of the review document does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purpose of confirmation. In other words, this is a recognition that we have reviewed the applicant for appointment only and doesn't set your opinion on it. With that, we have before the committee the appointment to the Board of Marine Pilots for Captain Michael C. Spencer of of Ketchikan. We don't have any testimony or witnesses on this. Any comments on Captain Spence? He's a reappointment. Representative Halcombe.
I see he puts down Representative Williams as a reference. I don't know what that is.
That's going to cost him with the judges.
To his favor, to have somebody put in their resume that they are happily married to their spouse is encouraging.
That makes
I'm
up for it.
Him,
that certainly makes up for it. I think even Bill would agree with that.
For a sailor, that's saying a lot.
I don't know. It's a little easier for a sailor.
Are there any any comments or objections of forwarding Captain Spence's nomination? Seeing none, we will forward that. Next, we'll take up the appointment of to the Board of Marine Pilots, Miss Barbara J. Huff Tuckness, Anchorage, for reappointment. Miss Tuckness, well known in this committee, Representative Murkowski.
Well, considering that she's not a Marine pilot, I'm assuming she's like the public representative.
Just
checking.
Any further comments from Barbara?
Huh?
I have talked to her about it. She seems to have enjoyed the appointment. It's a different part of life she hadn't experienced before. With that, is there any objections to forwarding Tuckness's name to the full body for confirmation? Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, brief at ease while we go on to pick up House Bill 345 on the last hearing. This was introduced by myself, and on the last committee hearing, we adopted the G version, and at that time, a number of members of the committee asked to have a public hearing on this rather than move the bill. And for the record, I explained to the committee, and we'll do so again, my intention for adopting this committee substitute and moving a bill was basically to get it on basis so people would understand what my intention of the bill was. I don't, unless there's a need for that, and because of the lateness of the session, I don't have an intention of moving the bill beyond the next committee referral. But I would like to get on basis so people can understand that. And I think that this deserves, and frankly, I want to thank the committee for asking me to take some people's time to listen to this. Chuck, did you need to get?
I'm fine.
Okay. And let me just review the background here. I think all of you have been on the committee long enough to know that we've got a concern about the health insurance and health care costs and affordability of all the people in the state of Alaska. And particularly, we have a concern about our own state employees and our own health insurance. So when it came to light, and I was thinking along the same plans, I intended to introduce a bill that would restrict the splitting up of the employment pool in the state of Alaska so it wouldn't have negative economic impacts on the cost of insurance by my way of thinking in a macro sense. That's all I had in mind. When the bill drafter came up with the first draft, it did not meet my requirements at all, and I don't think it even represented what my point of view was. So that's why it's very important that I make sure that I think everybody in the state employees in the state everybody in the state understands what the objective was here. The objective here was to, number one, is to allow the legislature to make the public policy. By the testimony of the Department of Administration from the overview hearing we had, we heard that the Commissioner Administration made a decision, he indicated on his own, to, in this last round of bargaining, the collective bargaining agreements, putting those together, that he would grant those collective bargaining units the right to establish their own health care trusts. And that's basically galvanized my action to introduce the bill so we could get some public discussion on this, because I think it's a very important point to understand. And I also had further discussions with Mr. Manafry, president of the AFL-CIO, who indicated that he is working to form the larger coalitions and working with the state employees right now. We do have a representative here from the Department of Administration. We'll be hearing from them and hearing from the various members of the collective bargaining units about what's going on in this regard. And my concern is this, and I think it's really quite, it's something that everybody needs to keep in mind. When you take the basic premise that an actuarial pool is to be smaller, then there's a smaller amount of covered lives to spread those risks over. I mean, this is, we can take that, this is dogma. I mean, that's true. And it's particularly important to consider when you have major, if we had AIDS, any AIDS cases that came to play, large heart surgeries, anything like that, and you have a large pool, when you're a self-insured pool, as we are now, those roll back and affect the cost of those people in the pool. We don't have a reinsurance cap because we have a large pool of covered employees. So my concern was giving up this right, not giving up the right, but just decreasing the amount of the people in the pool, and that's the problem. Then additionally, after my conversations with Mr. Fry, I have another concern, and that was from the testimony we had from Commissioner Poe. The idea was that the various collective bargaining units would set up their own trusts, and then they would enter into coalitions to get greater buying power and negotiating power. And my concern was this: that after having talked to Mr. Fry, I understood that there was some approximately 30,000 lives that were under the AFL-CIO trust in the Rail Belt area and statewide. And if they're going to enter into agreements to pull in the state employees under this net with these coalitions, that potentially, with some excess of 30,000 lives that would be cut, would be part of that, that particular umbrella organization could have as many as 60, 70,000 lives underneath it. And therefore, in the state of Alaska, this would be the 800-pound gorilla. And they would have the ability to do the bargaining with the healthcare providers and in such a way to get the very best of prices, which you think, well, that's a good thing. But I think all of us in this committee should know, or at least you should recognize in the healthcare game, if you will, anytime that there's a decrease in price, it becomes a cost shift type situation. And that's one of the problems, like we've talked about with the insurance mandates, things like that. When you get a cost shift situation, you'd have this large group of people going into a very small market, which is basically the state of Alaska, and those folks would get lower costs for their service, and everybody else would basically have to pay more. And so I think that is a responsibility on the part of the legislature to make sure that whatever happens with the state employees and how they are given their rights, or if they are given the right to leave the pool, that we need to know, number one, where they're going, and number two, how they're going to be administered. We have a responsibility to protect the state employees, and we have a responsibility to every other citizen in this state to make sure that their health insurance doesn't go up as a result of this type of action. And that is absolutely the reason I introduced this bill and no other. And With that, if there's any questions before we have, we do have a number of people that do want to testify. Tom, you're looking physically. Go ahead. Ask your question.
Frankly, through all the economics classes that I've had and all the studies I've seen, I don't see your concern. I don't see how making public employees pay $500,000 into a pool that they cannot participate in addresses your concern.
Oh, you're talking about the ACHEA part of the
We'll talk to the rest of the folks here, but your assertions for cost shifting, I think, are not accurate. And we'll just leave it at that, and I'll talk with the folks who are, or ask questions of the folks that are testifying.
Sure. And you're referring to the ACHEA contribution, is that correct?
I'm talking, first of all, Mr. Chair, about your assertion that establishing that organizations that establish self-insurance pools cause increases in health insurance for everybody, medical costs for everybody across the state. I disagree with that assertion. I think you're not making an accurate economic assumption there. But also then, if we want to attempt to bind folks who are trying to provide quality care as well as affordable care to their membership, and throw a $500,000 price tag on top of that, I think that
let's not debate the bill right now.
Okay, let's not. Hear from
it's
people.
It's a question of fairness as far as the ACHEA is. I mean, that's where that is. But let's not debate the bill. Let's hear some testimony and then we can go from there. I'd like to start out with Chuck, you've been waiting. You got to run. So why don't you come on up?
I can start.
Thank you, Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
My name is Chuck O'Connell. I'm the business manager with AFSCME Local 52, and we represent about 7,400 GGU members. I feel like I'm somebody with a big target on, because what this bill would do is it would make illegal the subject of negotiating health care for state employees like our members. The amendment addition of Section 3 says that that causes me a great deal of concern, because in July 1 of 1999 we were still at the bargaining table and under the terms of an expired contract. But aside from that, I think the greater concern that I have, and this is my true belief, is that if this bill in this form were to become law, it would increase the cost of health care for state workers rather dramatically. During the course of bargaining our contract, we got into, and albeit they were perhaps too public, but a number of disputes. Three unfair labor practices, all kinds of problems. We had our pay garnished. We got into an awful fight with the administration. And the reason we got into that dispute with the administration was we honestly believed, and our professionals believed and advised us, that we were paying too much for health care. And it turns out that in the end, we prevailed, our members got their money back, etc. And in going through that and looking at the rest of our brothers and sisters in organized labor, we looked at the other groups that had health care trusts and discovered that they were all paying less for health insurance than state employees. And the reasons are numerous, but we became absolutely convinced that we could provide lower cost health care for our members if we directly managed it through an independent trust managed by outside professionals. Currently, the information that we were given, for example, is that there are approximately 10 retirement and benefits employees in state government right now who are paid from our health insurance premiums to oversee the plan. Well, we wouldn't need that many employees to oversee the plan. We also looked at the administrative costs of the plan currently under state control. And the administrative costs under state control would be about at least $15 a month more than if we were to negotiate a third-party administrator outside of the procurement codes. And it became glaringly obvious to us that there were those kinds of cost efficiencies, as well as many more, that we could secure if we controlled the delivery of the plan. And so we did reach agreement with the commissioner that we would set up a trust. It is on our website. We currently have a draft declaration. We're in the process of selecting trustees as soon as our contract is ratified. And we think that we can dramatically bring down the cost of health care by moving in this direction. We also think that with the direct oversight, we can do things like audit claims, which are currently frankly not being audited. There are spots, but we would do it annually. We would also audit claims payment or premium payments by the administration. That's not being done now. There would be a lot more direct oversight over health care delivery under the health care trust. This bill would make that impossible for us. Quite honestly, we put our pants on one leg at a time, just like the other unions, and we would find it extremely offensive if we were prohibited as a matter of law from going out and taking advantage of the marketplace. Now, the other thing that I have to say is that the healthcare industry in the state of Alaska is a mature, professionally managed industry. It's very profitable. They know how to survive in the business world, and it seems to me that it is not necessary for the legislature of the state to put a mantle over them to protect them from the 1,000-pound gorilla, if you will. And I mean that with all due respect, Representative Roper. So for what it's worth, I'm very opposed to the bill. It would gut the second or third most important provision of our newly negotiated collective bargaining agreement, and I would respectfully ask you all to oppose the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
This is Mr. O'Connor. Well, Chuck, you and I go back a long ways, about 30-some years.
Yep.
Now, you truly believe that this bill was designed to protect the health care providers of the state?
If, as you say, it is to prevent large health care coalitions from forming, that is exactly what it would do.
No, the intention of the bill was, as I've indicated, was to keep the large pool of state employees together. That was the only intention of it. It had no... There was no intention of restricting the ability of collective bargaining units to bargain on health care benefits or anything like that. That was not my intention when I asked the drafter to draft the original bill.
I understand.
And you are knowledgeable about health care benefits. I mean,
somewhat, yes.
I mean, does the phenomenon of cost shifting, doesn't that take place in health care?
It does.
Right.
Very much so.
And could you explain to the committee how you perceive with the bargaining that's gone on? Because GGU has been somewhat different than some of the other bargaining groups because you've never really entered into it. There were some
right
different provisions. Can you kind of give us a little background there, and then also tell the committee how you you perceive the coalition thing happening, and then what you expect to gain out of that?
First of all, I have to qualify a little bit. Our members have a different health plan than all other state employees do.
Right, that's not like you.
It's all of our members have exactly the same coverage. There's no select benefits option. And we have preserved our insurance pool. By doing that, we have found that the costs of our plan are increasing slower than the other plans. And it would be our intention to maintain that structure in a trust situation. Now, the second part of your question, Representative Roeckberg, had to do with this coalition that's out there. And I think I need to talk about the coalition that's out there just briefly. You are correct that there are about 30,000 lives that are have access to the coalition. And the way it works is the coalition of labor unions has negotiated rates with certain providers. And each union has the option to purchase whether or not they want to use those providers. They're not all required to. Let me give you an example. The Labor's Union, the Iron Workers, and some of the others have a preferred provider arrangement with Alaska Regional Hospital. Teamsters Union, which is also a part of the coalition, has a preferred provider agreement with Providence Hospital. NEA, which has a very, very large union trust, has a preferred provider agreement with Providence Hospital. And what happens in the open market out there is each union is free to make its own deal with the most astute business persons in the healthcare industry.
But could you check on the interrupt right there?
Yeah.
Do they opt in or out on the same contract that's been already bargained? Do they go in there and bargain?
The only thing they bargain, Representative Roeckberg, is the amount of contribution that the employer pays. They don't bargain the preferred provider. They don't bargain the level of benefits. They simply bargain the amount of money that the employer is going to pay toward the cost of health care.
No,
it simplifies bargaining.
Right, but what I'm asking is like Providence or Alaska Regional, has that already been... That's a done deal that's been bargained by the coalition, and they opt in and out of that, or how does that work? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, everybody purchases the prescription drugs, and Don Valesco could probably speak more effectively because he's a part of the coalition, but not everyone participates in the hospital preferred provider deal, if you will, that the coalition.
I'll hold off on that. Maybe okay. We can even know more about it then.
But as to our intent,
right.
Fair question. Don't know. We've not made any commitments anywhere. We're going to be the large group on the block, but we are going to look at all of our options. And once we decide what is the best option for our members, that's the option we're going to take. And I don't know exactly at this point what that means. It might mean we'll fly everybody to Seattle. I don't know. I mean that facetiously. But and the other thing that we have that is somewhat different than some of the other groups is we've got members in every house district all over the state. And in that environment with that sort of a membership, just because you can make a good deal in Fairbanks doesn't benefit everybody, and the overall effect of that is not necessarily huge. So there's a lot to consider, but we're going to focus on it and we're going to consider it, and right now that's not being done.
That leads back to the question, I mean, wouldn't it be possible if you thought that the state was properly managing it to have more power and stay together as a unit? That's all I was trying to get at.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
No, I mean, because of your statewide exposure, don't you think you'd have a greater ability to do that? Or maybe the reluctance of the administration to enter into a PPO-type program would...
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. And I wouldn't blame the administration totally. There's been an awful lot of legislative interference over the years to prevent preferred provider agreements. You have to remember that whenever you have one, you have legislators in the constituent area where the preferred provider agreement has not been reached. So,
further questions, Mr. O'Connell, Representative Brooks?
Basically, what's driven you to go down this path of developing your own program? Has it been budget cuts and great desire to have reductions in cost, or?
That's a part of it. Our employees are paying a large amount of money for the amount of money that they make for health care. Mm-hmm. If we can lower that cost for them, mm-hmm. it might end up in having the effect of making our modest salary settlement more attractive. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly a consideration.
And one other one, you had said that the cost associated with health care provision, it's been growing at a slower rate under the type of agreements that we're looking to do away here with. Can you sort of thumbnail guess what kind of money you guys are able to save both membership and states and the state general fund in terms of doing these things?
No. I honestly can't, Representative Bryce. I know we can save money, but exactly how much I don't know.
Okay.
And I don't know whether or not we can continue to save money, but over the short term, I think we can bring about a number of cost efficiencies.
Okay. Great.
Chuck, what is it your plan is? What's the cost you plan now total that you have?
Currently, the total cost of the self-insurance plan that's in effect is $573 a month per member.
That your members are paying or responsible for now? Or?
Our members are paying $84.50 a month, and the employer's paying $488.50.
So the total cost is
$573.
That's what you're paying now?
Right.
And that's through the state, and that's the economy, like equivalent to the economy plan only, or what?
That's what would
comparable.
Commonly be referred to as an 80-20 plan, which is like the standard plan that you have.
Standard?
Yeah.
And you think you can save how much if you went out on your own?
I don't know. The only thing I can compare to is, with any real clarity, is we have 20 employees on my staff with AFSCME, and their current premium is $402 a month.
Under what?
With the Laborers Health Insurance Trust.
Well, they're under the one of that separate trust now. For what? For?
402.
402.
Mm-hmm. 570 and 402.
Then there's a little surcharge on that you told me the other day, or some other little.
That's it.
Oh, maybe it was the third party administrator. Okay. Very good. What about the ACHEA thing? Do you think it's fair that state employees?
I'm not familiar with the ACHEA thing.
It's the high risk pool. When we went self insured, before we all the state paid $1 million premium into our high risk pool, which we have to have for the Affordability Act.
If I understand this nonprofit incorporated legal entity, that was actually created for people that had a difficult time getting insurance.
That's correct.
And there's a very small pool.
It's 363 people.
Right. And it's a very expensive pool, I would imagine, which would require the catastrophic coverage that you're probably talking about, and again, I'm
right. It's an insurer of last resort, and it was put together for that purpose when people couldn't get it. And all the health insurance companies that do business in the state of Alaska, they do what above the high premiums that are paid in. They pick up the difference. And before the state of Alaska stepped out of and became self-insured, they paid approximately $1 million a year into that pool, or about $500,000, I think it was. Excuse me, no, it'd be about $500,000, right? So to keep the pool going, another thing is that because the Federal Affordability Act for all employees to be able to carry insurance around was passed 3 years ago, we have to have the pool under federal law, mm-hmm. to maintain our compliance. So it was good that we had it. And so it's kind of a whole chicken and egg thing. So it's a matter of fairness, because the other people in the state are having to pay for it, not state employees, when we stepped away from it. That's a classic example of cost shifting right there. And all the bill, that one section of the bill would say that the state employees have to make a prorated contribution to that. That's all. But anyway, just to represent Bryce.
Under what circumstances do state employees not get insurance? I mean, if they've got a catastrophic illness, they get hired, are they not insured by the state?
Well, the only people that aren't would be people that work less than 30 hours a week.
Okay, so if I come in with a predetermined condition, you know, I get my coverage?
Right.
Okay. So in other words, then, trying to apply the CHIA to state employees is kind of like trying to put an apple in an orange crate, given the fact that the CHIA is...
That's paying for a benefit that's not necessary.
Not necessary, and that they will never get. Okay.
Very good. Thanks very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Velasco, come on in. Is anybody online for this?
Yeah. Chairman Root, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. My name is Don Velasco. I'm the business manager of Public Employees Local 71. I've been a resident of this great state for, going back to 1955. And I've been happily married for 33 years. So I testify before you because I do have some concerns. And one, this bill, as I see it, would have little effect upon Local 71 and what its business would be, because Local 71 has been in the trust business for state employees. And I guess I should testify here that Local 71 represents some 1,700 people that work for the state. Now, they all don't work at the same time because we have seasonal people. At any given time, our members that are covered by our trust for state employees is approximately 1,390 to 1,485, somewhere in there, depending on the season as things fluctuate. So we have about 1,400 people covered at any one given day. I have a graph in our reports that we get that shows as the season it goes down and dips
back
up.
That's employees, all right?
That's employees of the state of Alaska at any one time. It's
how many covered lives, you have any idea?
Well, if you took 1,400 and you just about 2.6 or 7, whatever, 5, whatever it would be, is what we'd have there.
So about maybe 4,500.
That's real close to that, 4,000 or so. I don't have that exact figure. Trust does. I was appointed to Local 71's trust when it originally formed back in 1976 as a member that worked for the Department of Transportation. I was a member of Local 71 working for the Department of Transportation in Fairbanks, and I've served on that trust since. So I have 24 years of experience on Local 71's trust. The trust was formed, and I think history might help you here as I testify to get my knowledge of what has gone on and look at things. In 76, when we formed that, it was determined by our membership that they wanted better coverage than what the state was providing. So we formed what we called the trust to provide supplemental insurance. My recollection is the state had a plan that was close to the 80-20 that is current, and our members said we want some additional. So what the union did is at the table negotiated an additional 18 cents an hour to come out of the employees' wages to go into a trust fund so the trust could buy additional coverage from them. And basically what we did at that time was we provided a 90% plan. That's what our members wanted. They wanted an extra 10% coverage, some extra dental, those kind of things. That trust from 76 was in effect till 81-82, and at the time that the state opted out of the Social Security system and into the SBS system, and the state then made available for the employees of the state to buy additional coverage through the SBS system, that were things that they could take their SBS money and apply to that. We decided at that time that it didn't make sense for us to take out of their paycheck 22 cents an hour, and what it had gone over the couple of years in there, we negotiated an extra 4 cents an hour into that. We, in essence, said we're not going to deduct any more from the employee's paycheck because they can use the money that was made available from opting out of Social Security to buy this extra 10% coverage. And we went for a period of a year or two, and in that time, the trust had built up some reserves, and we took that money. I'm trying to, history gets, you have senior moments at this point trying to remember all of this. I can't remember whether it was at that time or another one, but when Sheffield became governor, we negotiated a full trust that would take all of the coverage that the state had. We negotiated X amount of dollars per hour, amount of cents per hour, to go into the trust, and we pulled away from the state's plan that everybody had and provided coverage, and that was through a bilateral trust. There was three straight trustees and three union trustees. Prior to that, our trust was strictly unilateral, only union trustees on it. That trust at that time lasted for 1 year. What we negotiated in money going into that, we built up a surplus of over $1 million. The next year, the Attorney General came down and made some ruling that says, well, we can't do this because of the statute, 393009, I believe was the statute at that time. And we went back under the state's plan. We took that $1 million and distributed it to all of our participants that were in the trust. Not very often you hear unions taking money that they've got and just distributing it out through a trust or anything else. There was other things we could have done. We could have bought life insurance policies and ran out the money and all of this. We still had, under Local 71, the original trust. And in 93, I believe it was, we renegotiated back with the Hickel administration to provide our full plan of coverage under a trust, a unilateral trust again. This was just strictly Local 71's trustees on there. And we were able to go out in the marketplace and put together a plan that called for 90% coverage that we could do out there. A lot of the things that kind of gives the history of my background with the trust. I've had 24 years on it. Maybe I should bring you up to one further date. 3 years ago, we changed our plan. Instead of it being a plan where all of our members can only have one thing, we changed into a flexible benefit. So what we have available to our members now is, if they happen to be a family member, they have a wife, children, spouse, children, dependents, whatever, they can elect for what we call Plan 101, which gives them 90% coverage, covers their family, their spouses, and everything else. If they happen to be a single person that has no other dependents, no family or anything, they can choose what we call Plan 105. Now, I guess I should get into the rates for this. The state currently contributes $550 a month for our health insurance plan. The members contribute $50 a month. Plan 101, $550 goes into it from the state, $50 goes into the member. On Plan 105, which covers people that want single coverage, they get the same plan, a 90% plan, same dental benefits, same vision coverage and everything else as a family person, but they don't pay the $600 contributed into there. The state still contributes $550 on their behalf. They still put in $50. But the plan only costs them like $325, something like that. So they get $275 that they can put on their check. We have two other plans, Plan 102, 103. That provides that 102 says it's an, let me get it right here, it's a 20% plan. Mm-hmm. So that 20% is covered for them. And this would be an example with somebody that's married. Their spouse has coverage, may have an 80% plan. So they only have to have 20%. That brings them up to 100% coverage. The 103 is a 30% plan. So if their spouse had a, say, a 70, they can still get 100. And there's rates for that. So they get a different plan, and they get money on their check. Now, it's after taxes. I mean, it's they got to pay taxes on it. So that's where we've evolved, and we've done this because it suits our membership. One of the big things that I have concern for and have had concern for is like with the state, when the state provides the coverage for the total group, the cost were going up like this. My concern when we got into it was what could we do to help bring this cost down? Well, I'll tell you this much. When a union communicates with its members, the members do listen. There's much more ability for the union to go out, meet with members, than it is for the state as an entity, as a bureaucracy, to talk with their employees and get them on board as far as doing things to cut costs. Better health deals that you do, and the different things. But we have the ability as members of a trust and with our union, we go out and meet with our members and say, hey, looks like rates are going up. You shouldn't be running to I'll use the emergency room as one that a lot of people do. Go to the doctor's office. Don't run to the emergency room. There's various things that we've done there that help lower the cost. One of the things I want to dispel here also is economy of size is not necessarily the best. We represent, Local 71 represents 300 custodians that work for the Anchorage School District. For a number of those years, we covered them from 81, I believe it was, till 88 under our trust. And through all of those years, the experience that we had for those 300 members was less than every other bargaining unit within the Anchorage School District. In 88, I won't go into depth in the details, we decided to turn that back over. It was more of a bargaining strategy than anything else, to the school district to cover them and put money on their checks instead of going into health insurance. The school district covers them. And we get the information from the Anchorage School District that shows by bargaining unit which group their experience is the lowest or the highest or whatever their experience is. And to date, our custodians there are the lowest in experience rating.
We get more exercise.
I sometimes wonder why. It works out that way. But I've done a lot as a trustee, and I understand that the people that use the healthcare industry the most that have coverage will be your doctors and nurses. Their rates will be higher than anybody else's if you just divide them into a group, unless you have maybe a high-risk industry that, I think of the labor industry, crab boats, that's not necessarily a health industry, but their risk has got to be higher as far as buying life insurance. So economy of size is not necessarily a driving factor, and I just point on the things that individual bargaining units should have the choice to deal for their members what best fits their members. And Chairman Roepberg, I think your concern is if the large groups pull out of the state, that it's going to cause the rates to go up for the people that are left. Mm-hmm. I respectfully say that isn't necessarily so. It could happen if the group that's left is a high user group, because the way the insurance industry works, if you pay this much for benefits, in other words, paid to the provider industry, hospitals, doctors, clinics, whatever, this much, your rate's going to match this and be a little bit more, usually. But if you use only this much over here, it's going to be that lower amount because the way the system really works.
Well, part of that's a little bit of a crapshoot, though, isn't it? Depends on how healthy that group is.
That group is. It depends on how healthy. And when you talk about cost shifting, I think when groups go out, and form a coalition. We're also Local 71 as part of the coalition that Mano has talked about, Chuck testified to. And that gives us an opportunity. And what we've joined them is we do use Alaska Regional as our preferred provider in Anchorage. We have different things that we can opt into the plan. If we want the vision services plan that the coalition has negotiated, we can take part in that. Fairbanks, they're working with a clinic up there to have something, and if we decided to buy into it, we could buy into that and say we'll take part of that. We are not locked into everything they provide. But I believe that's actually going to drive down costs of medical care in this state, because as we are able to get a group to negotiate with one set of providers, whatever they are, whether it's a clinic or whether it's a hospital, the others have got to look and say, in order for us to get the business, we're going to have to be competitive with them. The area where cost shifting takes place, I think, is when you're talking about free services. The cost shifting takes place when somebody walks into Providence that cannot pay the bill, or Alaska Regional, or into a clinic that cannot pay the bill. Who ends up paying it is those people that have coverage or that have the ability to pay out of their own pocket. But in this area, I sincerely believe we're going to be competitive in making the medical industry be cognizant of this, their rate of increase that they have, because they're so much higher above the CPI. I mean, anyway, that's pretty much, I think I've touched all I want. I'm open for any questions that anybody may have.
Just for starters, your trust, is it self-insured? Does it have, or is it, do you have an underwriter?
When I look at the terms that are used out there, we contract with United of Omaha at this point. That's the current provider that pays the medical claims. I mean, I would say we're self-insured.
Are they an administrator, or are they the underwriter? You pay them premiums?
We pay them premiums. It's like an underwriter, but it's kind of self-insured too. We reach an agreement that only so much will go into paying claims each month, and if it's at the end of the year, it costs them X amount of dollars over, they've borne that risk.
That's interesting. So there, you have a very variable menu that they offer, and their employees can enter into that. But you have an actual underwriter in place.
Right.
So you're not self-insured.
Not self-insured.
That means you're paying into a CHIA.
I suppose so.
That is. That's very true. You are, then, basically, because United of Omaha would be paying
their fair share into it.
Their fair share into it, yeah.
Right.
Very interesting.
We self-administrate. It's through the union. We've got our own administrator, you know, that takes care of paying the bills to United, paying and all of that.
Questions, Mr. Velasco? Mr. Velasco, I hope you understand that we sent you a message up there. I wasn't trying to put your trust out of business when I reduced the bill. So.
Well, I see that you're not, but I sincerely say I would testify in opposition to excluding other bargaining units from having the same opportunity that Local 71 has had to deal with their membership, to go out and look at health insurance and try and address their individual memberships. I don't think it would be fair to them. That's what I would say.
Well, that's that was another reason for the bill. I wanted to get a discussion there. What is the best way to approach the health insurance problem in the state? That includes all the bargaining units and all the uncovered people too. Well, I think you're coming here, I appreciate that, to tell the committee about your story, that you're actually able to go out, use a health insurance underwriter, give your membership some choice, and save money. What is your 80-40? What's the monthly cost to your member on that? The total cost of it.
Total cost, I'm not understanding.
Comparable to the 80-20 deal on the standard plan we have here in the state.
We don't offer an 80-20. We offer a 90-10
okay.
or a 20-80. In other words, the plan pays 20% and the other 80, they're at risk for, unless they have spousal coverage, then of course.
What's the 90-10 then? How much is that about?
That runs $600 a month for total cost.
Does that include vision and
that dental? Includes vision, dental, everything, and
and what's ours costing now for the 90-10? Anybody know?
You don't. I don't know what you have for a 90-10. That's. I guess you have different options here. Excuse me.
You know, Jeff.
And quite frankly, we'd be interested if the non-coverage with the state of Alaska might want to come under our trust, that we would be willing to negotiate something for them.
Well, we might be shopping here real shortly. That's another reason we're having this hearing. But thanks very much. We're going to run out of time. I wanted Allison to come on up.
Okay. That's a good organizing card, Norm.
I know. We've talked about this. This may be the way we have to go. We'll hire Tommy as our BA.
Anything to get me off the committee.
Welcome, Selgi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Allison Elgi, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. I previously testified on this bill, so I'll try to just, do a brief synopsis of the administration's position. We are opposed to this legislation. The first section that would bring state employees back in under the as participants in funding the CHIA pool, we don't believe there is any equity in that. We would be the only self-insured environment in the state participating. And because of the way our contracts work with a capped employer contribution, this increased cost would be borne entirely by employees. When the state participated in the CHIA pool prior to our going self-insured, the entire cost of health insurance was covered by the state. The employees did not participate. The concerns that we have about Section 3 and the inability of various bargaining units to move into a health trust environment, I think, have been very clearly outlined by the labor representatives here. We believe self-determination will, in fact, allow some of the health plan design changes that may be necessary in the future to control costs or perhaps reduce costs, and putting those management decisions in the hands of the employees themselves is the best way to go about accomplishing that. So we have a lot of hope for a health trust environment. There are a couple of things that I do want to clarify, and I think that Mr. O'Connell covered this, but we don't presently pool all of the state employees. We pool the general government unit apart from the select benefits people. So we're maintaining two separate environments in our health trust today. The implications of actually reducing the size of that pool are that we might have to look at a little different mix of self-insurance and stop-loss kinds of insurance if the pool were to get smaller. We purchase stop-loss for a variety of different purposes through our risk management program, and we would look at actually purchasing some kind of stop-loss coverage in if the pool got down to a size where we felt that was important in order to minimize the state's risk.
Uncovered employees, which amount to how many?
There are 2,000 non-covered employees, which is still a fairly sizable pool, and we have a ratio of about 2.7 covered lives, so it would be 4,700 covered lives that you'd be talking about looking at just the non-covered people.
But that would be one method. You could have a stop loss with a smaller pool.
Yes. Now, one of the bargaining units that's currently in a trust environment is the Public Safety Employees Association. That group is very small, and what they actually do in their trust environment is purchase an insured product. So that's the public safety employees. So, I mean, there are a very wide variety of options available to us to continue to provide coverage. But I think, as I said, the labor's representatives have talked very clearly about some of the advantages they would have in terms of exercising more cost control than we have the ability to do as a state entity.
Questions in this analogy. Allison, could you relate to the committee again why your boss is reluctant to enter into a PPO contract or the difficulties of the state doing it as a large group?
We have looked at the idea of going into a preferred provider agreement primarily in the Anchorage market, which is the only place that really has the volume to and the competition necessary in the healthcare market to make it effective. We've looked primarily at the hospital aspect of that and have actually explored that with some of the participants in the unions. For the select benefits plan, what we right now, because everybody is looking at the potential for a trust environment, we've not proceeded ahead, but what we've talked about in the select benefits environment is actually having an option as one of the things that people could select in that cafeteria plan design that would be a preferred provider option. The labor management group that we worked with looked at this last year and chose not to try to implement that option because we were still relatively new in a select benefits environment. And the concern they expressed was that the more choices you threw at the employees, the more difficulty the employees were going to have trying to make a meaningful selection for their own set of circumstances, that we ought to give employees a couple of years to actually become comfortable with the options that they had at that time before we introduced anything new. For the general government bargaining unit, their contract itself does not allow us to make any changes to the health benefit plan design without their concurrence. And so we would have to negotiate with them at the actual provision of a PPO option as a part of their plan design. And that's not really been a part of the conversation as we were trying to negotiate much bigger issues in terms of trying to get a whole new contract with them.
What questions, Ms. Elgin? So have you got a plan underway right now for the uncovered if the bargaining agreements are approved?
What we would really like to do is try to include the non-covereds if every state employee ended up in a trust environment, we would like to include the non-covereds in a trust environment as well, and that we could, you know, kind of have an arm's length relationship to, and allow them to have the same kind of self-determination in terms of plan design and participation in the health purchasing coalition. There are probably some legal impediments to that. We've got our attorneys looking at that right now and don't believe in the present statutory environment that we could just automatically do that. Meanwhile, however, we've got a whole bunch of little tiny units that are also participating in select benefits, and the non-covereds pretty much act as an anchor to that pool. So we need to be cognizant of what is going to happen to groups like the Masters, Mates, and Pilots. There's only 75 of them. You know, they need to be made a part of a broader plan that as we look at this whole healthcare trust environment, because there aren't enough of them by themselves.
So you think you can manage this whole situation without sticking together and lowering costs? Do you think there's been testimony and also comments made that the state employees had a good deal for too long and they overused the plan, and that's one reason they've driven the cost of the plan up? Is there any validity to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the escalators in healthcare nationwide have been for years a good deal higher than what you see in terms of just your general kind of cost of living adjustments for your broader consumer price index. In Alaska, we have been experiencing higher escalation of cost than in the lower 48, and that is primarily a result of our very small provider markets and the inability because of that for a lot of use of things like health maintenance organizations that have been utilized down south. We had a problem when we transitioned from the previous Aetna environment to our self-insured environment in 1997 in terms of essentially having a run on the plan. This is not uncommon where you're making changes and there is uncertainty on the part of the employees about whether those changes will impact the reimbursement they get or the timeliness of that reimbursement in the new environment. What that did was people shoved elective kinds of things, teeth cleaning, just their annual, you know, checkups. They shoved all of those things into a tighter time frame instead of spreading them out over the course of like a whole year so that they could get those things done prior to the implementation of the new environment. It ran down the available reserves to zero. So we started this self-insured environment with no reserves whatsoever. Part of what we have been doing in the